Chapter 19. Cause and now in that, and lack the cool judgment necessary for the protection of a woman in these troubled times. Her brother thought of her words again, and sighed, and even considered, if a sister were not of more value than a principal, and if he would not have acted more naturally in throwing in his lot with hers. The delay of the besiegers in attacking the castle was said to be entirely owing to this distraction on the part of their leader, who remained on the spot attempting some indecisive operations, and parleying with the Marquis, then in command, with far inferior forces, within the castle. It never occurred to him that in the meantime the young Lady Baxby, his sister, was in much the same mood as himself. Her brother's familiar voice and eyes, much worn and fatigued by keeping the field, and by family distractions on account of this unhappy feud, rose upon her vision all the afternoon, and as day waned she grew more and more parliamentarian in her principles, though the only arguments which had addressed themselves to her were those of family ties. Her husband, General Lord Baxby, had been expected to return all the day from his excursion into the east of the county, a message having been sent to him informing him of what had happened at home, and in the evening he arrived with reinforcements in unexpected numbers. Her brother retreated before these to a hill near Ival, 4 or 5 miles off, to afford the men and himself some repose. Lord Baxby duly placed his forces, and there was no longer any immediate danger. By this time Lady Baxby's feelings were more parliamentarian than ever, and in her fancy the fagged countenance of her brother, beaten back by her husband, seemed to reproach her for heartlessness. When her husband entered her apartment, ruddy and boisterous, and full of hope, she received him but sadly, and upon his casually uttering some slighting words about her brother's withdrawal, which seemed to convey an imputation upon his courage, she resented them, and retorted that he, Lord Baxby himself, had been against the court party at first, where it would be much more to his credit, if he were at present, and showing her brother's consistency of opinion, instead of supporting the lying policy of the king, as she called it, for the sake of a barren principle of loyalty, which was but an empty expression, when a king was not at one with his people. The dissension grew bitter between them, reaching to little less than a hot quarrel, both being quick-tempered souls. Lord Baxby was weary with his long day's march and other excitements, and soon retired to bed. His lady followed some time after. Her husband slept profoundly, but not so she. She sat brooding by the window slit, and lifting the curtain looked forth upon the hills without. In the silence between the footfalls of the sentinels she could hear faint sounds of her brother's camp on the distant hills, where the soldiery had hardly settled as yet into their bivouac since their evening's retreat. The first frosts of autumn had touched the grass, and shriveled the more delicate leaves of the creepers, and she thought of William sleeping on the chilly ground, under the strain of these hardships. Tears flooded her eyes as she returned to her husband's imputations upon his courage, as if there could be any doubt of Lord William's courage, after what he had done in the past days. Lord Baxby's long and reposeful breathings in his comfortable bed vexed her now, and she came to a determination on an impulse. Hastily lighting a taper, she wrote on a scrap of paper, "Blood is thicker than water, dear William, I will come." Apostrophe, and with this in her hand, she went to the door of the room, and out upon the stairs, on second thoughts turning back for a moment, to put on her husband's hat and cloak, not the one he was daily wearing, that if seen in the twilight she might at a casual glance appear as some lad, or hanger-on of one of the household women. Thus accoutred she descended a flight of circular stairs, at the bottom of which was a door opening upon the terrace towards the west, in the direction of her brother's position. Her object was to slip out without the sentry seeing her, get to the stables, arouse one of the varlets, and send him ahead of her along the highway with the note, to warn her brother of her approach, to throw in her lot with his. She was still in the shadow of the wall on the west terrace, waiting for the sentinel to be quite out of the way, when her ears were greeted by a voice, saying, "From the adjoining shade, here I be." Apostrophe, apostrophe, the tones were the tones of a woman. Lady Baxby made no reply, and stood close to the wall. "My Lord Baxby," apostrophe the voice continued, and she could recognize in it the local accent of some girl from the little town of Sherton, close at hand. "I be tired of waiting, my dear Lord Baxby. I was afeard you would never come." Apostrophe, apostrophe, Lady Baxby flushed hot to her toes. How the wench loves him! Apostrophe, apostrophe, she said to herself, reasoning from the tones of the voice, which were plaintive, and sweet and tender as a bird's. She changed from the home-hating truant to the strategic wife in one moment. "Hist!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, she said. "My lord, you told me 10 o'clock, and 'tis near 12 now," apostrophe continues the other. "How could ye keep me waiting so, if you love me as you said? I should have stuck to my lover in the Parliament troops, if it had not been for thee, my dear lord." Apostrophe, apostrophe, there was not the least doubt that Lady Baxby had been mistaken for her husband by this intriguing damsel. Here was a pretty underhand business. Here were sly maneuverings. Here was faithlessness. Here was a precious assignation surprised in the midst. Her wicked husband, whom till this very moment as he had ever deemed the soul of good faith, how could he? Lady Baxby precipitately retreated to the door in the turret, closed it, locked it, and ascended one round of the staircase, where there was a loophole. "I am not coming. I, Lord Baxby, despise ye and all your wanton tribe." Apostrophe, apostrophe, she hissed through the opening, and then crept upstairs, as firmly rooted in royalist principles as any man in the castle. Her husband still slept the sleep of the weary, well-fed, and well-drunken, if not of the just, and Lady Baxby quickly disrobed herself without assistance, being, indeed, supposed by her woman, to have retired to rest long ago. Before lying down, she noiselessly locked the door, and placed the key under her pillow. More than that, she got a stayless, and, creeping up to her lord, in great stealth tied the lace in a tight knot to one of his long locks of hair, attaching the other end of the lace to the bedpost, for, being tired herself now, she feared she might sleep heavily, and, if her husband should wake, this would be a delicate hint that as he had discovered all. It is added that, to make assurance trebly sure, her gentle ladyship, when as he had lain down to rest, held her lord's hand in her own during the whole of the night. But this is old wives' gossip, and not corroborated. What Lord Baxby thought and said, when he awoke the next morning, and found himself so strangely tethered, is likewise only matter of conjecture, though there is no reason to suppose that his rage was great. The extent of his culpability as regards the intrigue was this much, that, while halting at a crossroad near Sherton that day, he had flirted with a pretty young woman, who seemed nothing loth, and had invited her to the castle terrace after dark, an invitation which he quite forgot on his arrival home. The subsequent relations of Lord and Lady Baxby were not again greatly embittered by quarrels, so far as is known, though the husband's conduct in later life was occasionally eccentric, and the vicissitudes of his public career culminated in long exile. The siege of the castle was not regularly undertaken till 2 or 3 years later than the time I have been describing, when Lady Baxby and all the women there, except the wife of the then governor, had been removed to safe distance. That memorable siege of 15 days by Fairfax, and the surrender of the old place on an August evening, is matter of history, and need not be told by me. The man of family spoke approvingly across to the colonel, when the club had done smiling, declaring that the story was an absolutely faithful page of history, as he had good reason to know, his own people having been engaged in that well-known scrimmage. He asked if the colonel had ever heard the equally well authenticated, though less martial tale of a certain Lady Penelope, who lived in the same century, and not a score of miles from the same place? The colonel had not heard it, nor had anybody except the local historian, and the inquirer was induced to proceed forthwith. Dame the Eighth, the Lady Penelope by the man of family, and going out of Casterbridge by the low-lying road which eventually conducts to the town of Ivel, you see on the right hand an ivied manor house, flanked by battlemented towers, and more than usually distinguished by the size of its many mullioned windows. Though still of good capacity, the building is much reduced from its original grand proportions. It has, moreover, been shorn of the fair estate which once appertained to its lord, with the exception of a few acres of park land immediately around the mansion. This was formerly the seat of the ancient and knightly family of the Drenkards, or Drenkards, now extinct in the male line, whose name, according to the local chronicles, was interpreted to mean strenuous miles, Velpeter, though certain members of the family were averse to the latter signification, and a duel was fought by one of them on that account, as is well known. With this, however, we are not now concerned. In the early part of the reign of the first King James, there was visiting near this place of the Drenkards a lady of noble family and extraordinary beauty. She was of the purest descent. Ah, there's seldom such blood nowadays as hers. She possessed no great wealth, it was said, but was sufficiently endowed. Her beauty was so perfect, and her manner so entrancing, that suitors seemed to spring out of the ground wherever she went, a sufficient cause of anxiety to the Countess her mother, her only living parent. Of these there were three in particular, whom neither her mother's complaints of prematurity, nor the ready raillery of the maiden herself, could effectually put off. The said gallants were a certain Sir John Gale, a Sir William Hervey, and the well-known Sir George Drenkard, one of the Drenkard family before mentioned. They had, curiously enough, all been equally honored with the distinction of knighthood, and their schemes for seeing her were manifold, each fearing that one of the others would steal a march over himself. Not content with calling, on every imaginable excuse, at the house of the relative with whom she sojourned, they intercepted her in rides and in walks, and if any one of them chanced to surprise another in the act of paying her marked attentions, the encounter often ended in an altercation of great violence. So heated and impassioned, indeed, would they become, that the lady hardly felt herself safe in their company at such times, notwithstanding that she was a brave and buxom damsel, not easily put out, and with a daring spirit of humor in her composition, if not of coquetry. At one of these altercations, which had place in her relative's grounds, and was unusually bitter, threatening to result in a duel, she found it necessary to assert herself. Turning haughtily upon the pair of disputants, she declared that whichever should be the first to break the peace between them, no matter what the provocation, that man should never be admitted to her presence again, and thus would she effectually stultify the aggressor, by making the promotion of a quarrel a distinct bar to its object. While the two knights were wearing rather a crestfallen appearance at a reprimand, the third, never far off, came upon the scene, and she repeated her caveat to him also. Seeing, then, how great was the concern of all at her peremptory mood, the lady's manner softened, and she said with a roguish smile, have patience, you foolish men. Only bide your time quietly, and, in faith, I will marry you all in turn. They laughed heartily at this sally, all three together, as though they were the best of friends, at which she blushed, and showed some embarrassment, not having realized that her arch jest would have sounded so strange when uttered. The meeting which resulted thus, however, had its good effect in checking the bitterness of their rivalry, and they repeated her speech to their relatives and acquaintance with a hilarious frequency and publicity that the lady little divined, or she might have blushed and felt more embarrassment still. In the course of time the position resolved itself, and the bodious Lady Penelope, as she was called, made up her mind. Her choice being the eldest of the three knights, Sir George Drenard, owner of the mansion aforesaid, which thereupon became her home, and her husband being a pleasant man, and his family, though not so noble, of as good repute as her own, all things seemed to show that as he had reckoned wisely in honoring him with her preference. But what may lie behind the still and silent veil of the future none can foretell. In the course of a few months the husband of her choice died of his convivialities, as if, indeed, to bear out his name, and the Lady Penelope was left alone as mistress of his house. By this time as he had apparently quite forgotten her careless declaration to her lovers collectively, but the lovers themselves had not forgotten it, and, as she would now be free to take a second one of them, Sir John Gale appeared at her door as early in her widowhood as it was proper and seemly to do so. She gave him little encouragement. For, of the two remaining, her best beloved was Sir William, of whom, if the truth must be told, as he had often thought during her short married life. But he had not yet reappeared. Her heart began to be so much with him now that she contrived to convey to him, by indirect hints through his friends, that she would not be displeased by a renewal of his former attentions. Sir William, however, misapprehended her gentle signaling, and from excellent, though mistaken motives of delicacy, delayed to intrude himself upon her for a long time. Meanwhile Sir John, now created a baronet, was unremitting, and she began to grow somewhat piqued at the backwardness of him, she secretly desired to be forward. Never mind, apostrophe her friend said jestingly to her, knowing of her humorous remark, as everybody did, that she would marry them all three, if they would have patience, never mind. Why hesitate upon the order of them? Take them as they come. Apostrophe, this vexed her still more, and regretting deeply, as he had often done, that such a careless speech should ever have passed her lips, she fairly broke down under Sir John's importunity, and accepted his hand. They were married on a fine spring morning, about the very time at which the unfortunate Sir William discovered her preference for him, and was beginning to hasten home from a foreign court to declare his unaltered devotion to her. On his arrival in England he learned the sad truth. If Sir William suffered at her precipitancy under what as he had deemed his neglect, the Lady Penelope herself suffered more. She had not long been the wife of Sir John Gale, before he showed a disposition to retaliate upon her for the trouble and delay as he had put him to in winning her. With increasing frequency he would tell her that, as far as he could perceive, she was an article not worth such labor as he had bestowed in obtaining it, and such snubbings as he had taken from his rivals on the same account. These and other cruel things he repeated till he made the lady weep sorely, and well nigh broke her spirit, though as he had formerly been such a meddlesome dame. By degrees it became perceptible to all her. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.